Welcome back to the Environmental Law Monitor. I'm your host, Daniel Pope. This podcast is brought to you by Bracewell LLP's Environment, Lands, and Resources Practice Group, and it's a place for thoughtful conversations. We have conversations ranging from the latest developments to perennial topics like litigation, enforcement, and compliance assurance. We're glad you're spending some time with us today. Today, I'm excited to announce that the Monitor family is growing. We're welcoming Taylor Stewart, an associate in our Washington, D.C. office, as a host of the podcast. So now we are co-hosts. This is a pretty exciting day for me. I'm sure it's an exciting day for you. As long as Taylor doesn't perform some sort of hostile takeover of the podcast and kick me out, you'll be hearing from both of us, and I'm excited about new opportunities for the podcast. If you've been a longtime listener of the pod, you may remember Taylor from some of her earlier contributions, but you'll definitely be hearing from her more regularly in future episodes. So welcome, Taylor. It's so great to have you.
Thank you, Daniel. It's great to be here. And I could never perform any hostile takeover because Daniel has built such a successful podcast here. I think it's really helpful to our clients and really anyone that's interested in kind of hot topics in environmental law. So we would be lost without you, Daniel, but I'm excited to join and make any contribution I can to the podcast family.
You know, that's precisely the kind of anxiety relieving statement somebody who is maybe possibly thinking about a hostile takeover would say.
Right.
But I will be watching my back. At any rate, so Taylor, I have kind of a random question for you before we jump into our topic today. Are you a Halloween person?
I am a Halloween person. I think, you know, as I've gotten older, I think I'm a less enthusiastic Halloween person, but there's always some party, some trick-or-treating event that I'm dressing up for. So, I always enjoy it.
So I've not been a Halloween person. I mean, aside from like taking some of my children's candy, I have typically not done anything for Halloween. But this Halloween, I decided that I was going to read some scary stories and try to get into the spirit of October that way. And so I read some Edgar Allan Poe. I read that Agatha Christie Halloween story, yeah, which is really actually just a murder mystery. There's not very much scary about it. So it was kind of an error on my part. And then I read some H.P. Lovecraft, and especially with Edgar Allan Poe and Lovecraft, they show sort of the world as being a chaotic place. And when people encounter the chaos that is the bottom of the world, they're taken to the edge of sanity. And the reason I bring that up is that I had a similar experience reading those stories for Halloween as I do whenever I try to peer over and see what's going on with the good neighbor rule and litigation over the good neighbor rule, where it's in effect and making sense of it. That's not an area that I've practiced a lot in, but I know you're involved in it. And so I have that sort of same like edge of sanity experience whenever I glance over at what is going on. So I'm excited that you're here to help us understand. Taylor, take it away, introduce our guest, and we're so excited you're here.
Of course. Thanks, Daniel. And I think Edge of Sanity is another good proposed title for this podcast. Daniel and I also talked about demystifying the good neighbor rule for dummies, similar titles. I don't know that we need to take it that far, but that's another good idea. And I am excited to talk about the good neighbor rule. We're joined by Brittany Pemberton, who is a partner in our Environmental Lands and Resources group here at Bracewell. Brittany has been a Clean Air Act practitioner for almost 10 years now and is the person that anyone should go to if they have good neighbor rule questions. So we're excited to have her with us. Welcome, Brittany.
Thanks, Taylor. I'm excited to be here.
Great. So we can maybe kick it off by trying to keep it really high level. It's easy, I think, at least this is how I feel about all Clean Air Act programs and regulations. EPA does a lot under that statute, and it's hard to keep track of. So we'll try to keep this one high level and just talk about, you know, what is the good neighbor rule? How is it affecting regulated industries right now? And what's going on with the litigation, which I think is the real money question in all of this, because all of us wake up every morning with emails and newsletters about the status of the litigation and what's going on there. And I think anyone could benefit from an update on that front. So what is the good neighbor rule? The good neighbor provision of the Clean Air Act is a portion of the Clean Air Act that basically prohibits upwind states from interfering with downwind states ability to comply with EPA's air quality standards. Brittany, do you think I put that in simple enough terms, or do we think we should elaborate there?
No, I think that is a nice succinct way to say it. It's all about good neighbor attitudes, I think, under the Clean Air Act. We want to make sure that states around the country that are having problems getting into attainment with various NAAQS standards aren't further impeded by emissions that are coming from states that are upwind of them.
Yep, that's right. So when we're talking about these NAAQS, I think we could go back a bit to 2015 to talk about kind of the origin of why we're talking about the good neighbor provision now. So in 2015, EPA set more stringent National Ambient Air Quality Standards, or NAAQS. And as a result, under the Clean Air Act, states have to submit state implementation plans, sometimes called SIPs. We'll try not to over acronym this podcast for our guests, but those are often called SIPs. And the state implementation plans essentially outline how the state intends to comply with their Clean Air Act obligations, including the good neighbor rule, or the good neighbor provision rather. And states were required to submit their SIPs that outlined how they plan to comply with the 2015 air quality standards in 2018. So that's many years ago now, and that's the origin of this story. So in 2023, in February of 2023, EPA announced that it would disapprove those state implementation plans because they weren't compliant with the Clean Air Act's good neighbor provision. And they made that decision for 23 states. Is that right, Brittany? 23? I know there's some up and downs about the numbers.
Yeah, 23 states. There were a handful of states that EPA actually took comment on whether to apply this federal implementation plan against, and they ultimately decided to defer that decision. And also wanted to mention, just to be clear, that we're talking specifically about standards for ozone. As I think a lot of our listeners probably know, there are 6 criteria pollutants that EPA can regulate under the NAAQS, but we're talking specifically just about the ozone standards that were tightened in 2015.
Yep, just another example of there being many, many worlds within the Clean Air Act. And as Brittany said, EPA did come up with a federal implementation plan to enforce for states whose state implementation plans they chose to disapprove. So this federal implementation plan was finalized in June. This is what we're referring to as the Good Neighbor Rule or the Good Neighbor Plan. And in this June final rulemaking, EPA sought to create an implementation plan that applies to the states in which the disapproved SIPs are no longer applicable. And EPA set out a number of different requirements that seek to ensure that those states are compliant with the good neighbor provision. So that's a little bit of kind of how we got here.
And one of the things I'd add to that I think is a little bit interesting, a little bit of intrigue perhaps, is that EPA usually, when it disapproves SIPs, it gives the states an opportunity to try again. And for whatever reason here, it went straight to the FIP. You know, the SIP disapprovals were finalized earlier this year, and within, you know, a matter of months, the FIP was also, the good neighbor plan itself was also finalized. So not a lot of opportunity there. I mean, no real opportunity for states to try to correct any shortcomings that EPA may have identified in their plans.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so if I'm hearing both of you correctly, both of you have been spending so much time with the good neighbor rule that I thought we had to have you on. But as I'm trying to become wiser about the good neighbor rule myself, I mean, I guess let me know if you disagree with this kind of summary. But under the good neighbor rule, states have an obligation to not interfere, as you know, as you pointed out, Brittany, with the ability of downwind states to meet their air quality standards. States try to incorporate the good neighbor rule into their state implementation plans, their SIPs, and they have to have those approved by EPA. EPA has disapproved a handful of them. Other states are trying to absorb the good neighbor rule into their SIPs, and we're kind of watching to see what happens, which states will have their SIPs approved. And then Brittany, you said that EPA has put in a FIP instead of allowing states to sort of cure and come back and say, oh, sorry, we got it wrong, we fixed it, approve our SIP, please, EPA has just gone straight to federal implementation plans. And is that just for ozone, or is that for every criteria pollutant?
It's just for ozone, and specifically the 2015 ozone max. There is a 2008 ozone standard that has its own, you know, good neighbor provisions and in various SIPs, and we're not doing anything to disturb that. This is just the latest iteration of the ozone standard.
This just makes me sort of think of like Goodwill Hunting and somebody doing really complex math to track all these different things and massive chalkboards.
Yeah, I feel a little bit like Goodwill Hunting sometimes when I'm trying to keep track of everything that's going on. I think Brittany and others who are really experienced Clean Air Act practitioners, I think that they look at this and understand it in a much clearer way than I do. So there's no riddled chalkboard in the back of Brittany's office. I think she has a pretty good handle on all of these things. So maybe we can talk a little bit about, you know, what does the Good Neighbor Plan or the Good Neighbor Rule, the federal implementation plan that goes by many names, but what does it require that states do now that their implementation plans are disapproved? Brittany, can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So the rule applies to a bunch of different sources, in the main electric generating units, so all your power plants, and then what EPA likes to call non-electric generating units, non-EGUs, which is a range of other industrial stationary sources. So in this rule, they have gone farther than they really have in any prior good neighbor implementation rule that they have done to reach emissions from like pipeline engines, cement kilns, furnaces, and different boilers used in a bunch of industrial applications like iron and steel mills, glass manufacturing, paper mills, that sort of thing. The requirements that are in the rule for those various sources are different depending upon what is being regulated, which I think makes sense. But, you know, in general, the idea is to reduce emissions of NOx, which is an ozone precursor, so that those sources are eliminating whatever significant contribution they are making to the downwind non-attainment problems that we've been talking about. How would they do that? In general, it's through retrofitting emission controls on, you know, the emission source. Or in the case of the electric generating units, what EPA found was that there are additional emission reductions that are out there that could be achieved in sort of the nearer term just by actually having those sources sort of maximize controls that are already installed. EPA found for whatever reason there are power plants that are not running their controls, you know, consistently. And if they just took that step, then that would reduce emissions to a certain degree. And so EPA sort of envisioned this phased in approach, especially for the power plants where you're maximizing what you have installed to begin with, then you're installing additional or controls for the first time to get even more reductions. And then the third phase, as EPA sees it, is really eliminating or reducing the emissions in a significant way from all of those industrial sources that we were talking about. So the rule kicked in summer of 2023 here, but it phases in over time. So those industrial sources don't have to have controls installed until May of 2026. That's really their compliance deadline.
Okay. And Brittany, I've also seen something about a trading program in connection with the Good Neighbor Rule. What can you tell us about that? That may be its own podcast one day, but just briefly.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. You know, there it's a fairly involved area of the Good Neighbor Rule. So rather than bore our listeners with a ton of detail on that, I'll just mention that, you know, it's a key difference in how EPA is treating those power plants, the EGUs and the industrials, and sort of a feature of how it's always managed ozone good neighbor issues. And that is by implementing that trading program. As I think most of our listeners will appreciate, there's a lot more flexibility to comply with reduced emissions through a trading program than by just mandating a mass or a rate-based obligation for every single unit that you have to meet. You know, the idea is that the states get certain allowances that decrease over time throughout the, you know, several year period that's covered by the rule. And they can allocate those then to the various emission units, the various power plants within the state. But the idea is that creates a market so that these participants regions, the affected units can decide whether it's more economical for them to juice up their controls or to add or change out to some other emission control or to just buy allowances on the marketplace. You know, it gives those, all of those units compliance flexibility. And the, you know, emission reductions that I was talking about earlier that are phased in are all part of that scheme. You know, it's not as if there's a certain point in time by which EGUs have to install a certain control to get to a certain level. But the idea is that EPA designed that phased down approach in the emissions to coincide with some lead time to give all of these EGUs the opportunity to consider, you know, what are we going to do? How do we want to comply? Is it consistently running those controls? Is it adding new controls? So the emissions go down as those units have time to make those decisions and actually enact those changes, or you have the opportunity because you get some allowances to then trade in the program.
That makes sense. So, you know, for facilities where it would be easy to reduce NOx emissions, or relatively easy, they can do that quickly and then start selling their reductions or the credits that represent those reductions to facilities that may have a harder time reducing their. And so you've got that internal flexibility within a state. Okay, that's helpful.
Yeah, and maybe talking a little bit about the economics of the rule, as Brittany mentioned, I think, you know, EPA recognized in places in the rule that for some sources and for some regulated industries that it would be difficult to comply with these limits or to install certain pollution control measures in the amount of time allotted by the rule. And one of the ways that EPA tried to address this, and there's debate between EPA and regulated industries about whether this really addresses it or not, but you know, one way they tried to address this is through up to a year-long compliance extension or case-by-case alternative emission limits for certain sources who can show that there's extreme economic hardship. So unclear maybe from the face of the rule how exactly EPA would allow certain sources to fall within those exceptions, but they did try to kind of incorporate some flexibility there, and it's maybe up for debate whether that flexibility was really achieved or whether sources essentially still have to come into compliance absent, you know, extreme economic hardship. Not sure what that means from the face of the rule.
Yeah, I think those are great points, Taylor. You know, EPA really, I guess to its credit, was reacting to comments that it received on the proposed Good Neighbor rule about concerns over how hard it would be and perhaps impossible to meet the compliance deadlines in the rule and to meet the emission reductions that are you know, going to be phased in. And so it tried to build in some of these compliance flexibilities. I think industry has a fair amount to say about how good of a job EPA did on that, as you said, at least on the face of things. And we'll have to sort of see how the implementation of all of that shakes out.
So now getting to maybe the litigation element of it, which we mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, there's a few buckets of litigation here. We can maybe think about them in a couple phases. The first phase sought to challenge this kind of first action by EPA, which disapproved a number of the state implementation plans. So states and certain industry groups went out to regional circuits seeking to stay the implementation of the state implementation plans. Brittany, do you want to talk a little bit about the geography of all that? Because I think that's probably one of the questions that we get the most from people is what's going on around the country? Because it seems that there's state by state, there's a little bit of a different state of play.
Yeah, that's right. You know, EPA's action on the various SIPs was a single, you know, sort of, for lack of a better word, you know, it looks like a rule. It was published in the Federal Register, but it applies to individual state implementation plans for those 23 states that are at issue in the rule. So EPA's view on that in their decision was that any litigation on the SIP disapprovals needed to be heard in the DC Circuit. That comes out of the Clean Air Act. You know, there's a particular judicial review provision in the Clean Air Act that not only gives circuit courts jurisdiction over final agency actions under the Clean Air Act, but then also talks about what the right venue is. If a decision is locally or regionally applicable, like you would think the disapproval of a state implementation plan might be, then it belongs in those regional circuits, the first, the second, the third, et cetera. If the decision, if EPA's decision is nationally applicable, then the Clean Air Act says we have to litigate this in the DC circuit. And then there's an additional exception to that locally originally applicable bit, which is that if it is locally originally applicable, but nonetheless is of nationwide scope and effect, then it has to go to the DC circuit. So you had all of these states and various industry, you know, power plant, industrial companies filing challenges to the disapproval of their SIPs in the regional circuits because, you know, sort of the well-accepted wisdom, I guess, around the legal world is that you often have a better chance of success when you are suing the federal government and particularly EPA if you're not doing that in the DC circuit. So they went out to these regional courts, had a big fight with EPA about whether that was the right venue or not, because EPA took the view in the final action disapproving the SIPs that this is of nationwide scope and effect and belonged in the DC circuit. And a number of those litigants were successful. And so those cases are being litigated all at the same time in those regional circuits. And so that has led to some interesting results. Probably most of our listeners that have been at least trying to keep up on all of the news on the Good Neighbor Rule are aware that those litigants actually filed, a number of them filed motions to stay the underlying SIP disapproval, and they succeeded there too. And so what that actually means right now is that there are 12 state implementation plan disapprovals that have been stayed: Arkansas, Kentucky, Louisiana, Mississippi, Missouri, Texas, Alabama, Minnesota, Nevada, Oklahoma, Utah, West Virginia. I think I got them all. And so EPA's reaction to that was to issue this interim final rule to make it clear that while those state implementation plan disapprovals have been stayed, what that means for the Good Neighbor Rule, which I think is a good segue into the litigation on that, what it actually means is that the Good Neighbor Rule can't be implemented either. The SIP disapproval is a necessary precedent to EPA getting to implement a federal implementation plan. You know, if the SIPs have been approved, then there's no room for EPA to step in and issue a FIP. So staying the disapproval means no Good Neighbor Rule in effect at this point in time in all of those states that I just rattled off.
So we're sort of back into the patchwork problem, right? Where you've got, if you're looking at a map, you'll see, you know, two different shades of where the Good Neighbor Rule is in effect and where it's not, and where there's, you know, pending litigation. This, you know, I was kind of being cute earlier when I was talking about scary Halloween stories, but trying to get this all sorted and make sense of it, I think, is a real challenge and can lead to a few nightmares. Maybe not complete madness in the sort of H.P. Lovecraftian or Edgar Allan Poe sense, but still really challenging.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you add to that, then all of the litigation on the Good Neighbor Rule itself, and the fact that there were a couple of cases filed to challenge the interim final rules that I mentioned that EPA just issued to make clear what the effect of those stays of the SIP disapprovals are, there's just a heck of a lot to keep on top of. On the Good Neighbor Rule litigation itself, a lot of those parties filed in the DC circuit, I think, you know, so on the Good Neighbor Rule itself, a lot of those litigants did go to the DC circuit, but then there are a number of parties that filed in the regional circuits again to try their hand in case they could, you know, get better odds with a different set of judges. Most of those local cases are on hold because the DC circuit is really sort of considered to be the main case, and that's what's going forward. And of note there, I guess, is that you also saw a number of litigants file stay motions in the DC circuit. Ultimately, those have not been successful, but they have taken their challenge up to the Supreme Court, and we are at the moment waiting to hear from that court as to whether it might stay even the Good Neighbor Rule itself. That could shake out maybe in a variety of ways. Some of the litigants that have gone to the Supreme Court have asked for a stay that would affect just their industry. You know, that's the case for natural gas transmission pipelines. Others have asked for something a little bit broader. So if the court were to issue a stay, it'll be interesting to see exactly how broad the reach of that might be.
Yeah, so it is difficult to keep track of all that litigation. And first, for industries that are, or, you know, companies that are located in states where the federal implementation plan or the Good Neighbor Rule is not stayed, maybe we can think about things that they should keep in mind or issues that they might come across. I mean, I think the first, Brittany, is probably just short timeframes for compliance, right? So regulated entities that are in states where the rule is not stayed, they, you know, likely need to begin planning now for compliance in order to ensure that, you know, for EGUs, they're in compliance by about, you know, August of 2024. And then for non-EGUs, if they're in compliance around, you know, May 2026, that next 2026 ozone season. And depending on the sources that each entity needs to bring into compliance, you know, this process could be pretty onerous. And many industries argue at the moment that it's infeasible and that some of the exceptions that EPA provides to them maybe won't quite do the trick to give them enough time to comply. And maybe one question we should talk about is, do we think EPA will give, for entities and states that are subject to the stay, do you think that they'll have more time to come into compliance after those stays are lifted at the end of judicial review? Or do we think that EPA will still say, we'll see you in 2026?
I think that's a good question. I think it's likely that EPA will give additional lead time on the back end of any of those, of the litigation where the stays have been granted when all of that is lifted. And they've telegraphed as much in the second interim final rule that they issued. They actually made some remarks that sort of go to this point, saying that they can't predict how their future action may affect everything that's being finalized in the interim final rule, but the states that are gonna, that are covered by it, you know, those that have had their SIP disapprovals stayed, will be able to phase in requirements once the stay is listed, so as to provide lead times to implement the good neighbor plans, you know, emission controls strategies that are comparable to the lead times that would have been effect, you know, absent the stay, essentially. In other words, you know, EPA hasn't come out and said, if the stay lasts 18 months, we'll be sure to give you another 18 months, you know, of lead time to come into compliance. But they have said that their goal is to give comparable lead times.
If my eyes glazed over as we were talking, it's because I was thinking about something that I don't think we've talked about sort of in our green room, but with these compliance and lead times, with all of the litigation over the rule, I'm also thinking about, will the election in 2024 affect the good neighbor rule at all? And the way that we saw with several EPA policies in the transition from the Obama era to the Trump presidency, like the Clean Power Plan and then the ACE rule, and just the sort of the regulatory back and forth that we're seeing so much now in a lot of different contexts. I was wondering if that's also going to be sort of an asterisk that's hanging on all of these compliance deadlines and whether we'll see any sort of shifting positions from the agency. But that's just sort of rank speculation. That's sort of rank punditry. And maybe we need to send you guys down the hall in the DC office to go grab the PRG folks to do some of that punditry. But no, I think that's so interesting to think about, in addition to all the litigation, the sort of staggered compliance deadlines. And it's just really a moving target. There's a lot of uncertainty here. And I think maybe the biggest takeaway from this podcast is that you should call Brittany and Taylor if you have any questions applicable to a specific project or issue.
If I could say one more thing on sort of the lead time and the difficulty of getting into compliance, you know, this is a big issue in particular for those industrial sources. I think in more than one instance, the required controls may be in short supply. There's not a huge market of vendors who are able to design, produce and install those controls. And so there's sort of limited resources that have to be spread around fairly large industries. And that was something that, you know, EPA had every opportunity to react to from comments that were filed on the proposal. We got some of those compliance flexibilities that Taylor was talking about earlier, you know, the opportunity to get case by case emission limits if it looks like it would be a financial hardship for you to get all the way into compliance. Also, some extensions that are available under the rule. But one of the things that really underpins, really, I guess, the opportunity to take advantage of those case by case and extensions is that you have to be able to show that you took every step possible to meet the requirements of the rule as dictated by the rule, to get controls installed by the right time limit, you know, to meet the emission limits by the deadline. All of, you have to take every step you possibly can.
I think your point about the availability of pollution control equipment is really significant. This is not like going and buying a new phone charger, or you can't buy this on Amazon and get it primed to you in a couple of days, right? This is highly custom, advanced industrial equipment that involves a huge manufacturing process, a lot of lead time, a lot of design work.
permitting. That's another concern, you know, the amount of time that it will take to get Title V permits amended and things like that to actually operate these controls. All of that feeds into concerns about whether the compliance timelines in the rule are at all feasible, which really, you know, underscores the impact that this may have on regulated entities in the states that are not subject to a stay at this point in time. They already need to be planning for compliance absent intervention by the Supreme Court.
And as you pointed out, Brittany, I mean, I think it's not only, you know, availability of these controls, it's vendors too. You know, we saw a lot of commenters note that the, you know, supply chain issues and availability of vendors, when all of these industries run out to market and say, you know, we all need these controls, what does it look like to be able to procure vendors in order to install all of these when you're all doing it at once? And I think EPA's, you know, response to some of those concerns was essentially supply chain pressures are lowering and we think you'll be able to pull it off. Seems like the industries are still pretty concerned about whether that's really feasible or not, and whether EPA, whether it's kind of timing report or analysis of feasibility took into account everything that's going on the commercial side to try to logistically figure out how to come into compliance in this time frame. So there's a lot to keep track of on the Good Neighbor Rule. We hope that no one's eyes have glazed over more than Daniel's. He's our litmus test of whether we are explaining this in a way to make sense to everyone and to actually be useful. But as Daniel said, if you ever want to talk these issues through, the Bracewell team is happy to have conversations like this with anyone about the Good Neighbor Rule. And we continue to keep track of these issues and to be interested in the status of the litigation and how all of those decisions will shake out. Daniel, Brittany, any kind of closing final thoughts that you want to add?
I'll just say that I'm significantly less terrified having talked with you about this. So it's helpful to think about litigation over this rule, right? I mean, the Good Neighbor Rule is sort of like this big umbrella, and there are a lot of different specific discrete topics. Like, Brittany, it was really helpful to hear you explain the role that the stay of the SIP disapprovals played in all this process, right? I feel wiser about this. I'm still going to call both of you if I ever get a question about this Good Neighbor Rule, but no, that's very helpful.
Well, we are tracking it all. So I'm sure we'll have an answer at the ready when you call.
That's right. Well, it was really great acting as co-host on my first Environmental Law Monitor podcast. Thank you, Daniel, for having Brittany and I on. As always, we'd like to thank Dorn and Emily, our great podcast team that works so hard to create this product for you and make sure that we sound good on the back end. So thank you to our Bracewell podcast team for all of their help there. And we will see our guests on the next episode.